From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Benjamin Cheever has just published a collection of letters written by his late father, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Cheever. On this edition of Fresh Air, Ben tells us that the most difficult revelation was the extent of his father's homosexuality. We also take a look at the state of the art world with writer Calvin Tompkins. The best of his New Yorker articles have just been published in a new book. On our weekly performance segment, new music composer and accordionist Guy Klusevic plays excerpts of his tribute to polka music, Polka from the Fringe. He's performing the entire work next week at the Next Wave Festival. And critic at large Laurie Stone reviews Hotel Terminus, the new film about Nazi Klaus Barbie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and short story writer John Cheever used to say that he wrote to make sense of his life. His daughter Susan took that to heart, and after her father died in 1982, to better understand him, she wrote a book about his life. After completing it, she thought she knew him better than she ever did while he was alive. Now Cheever's son, Ben, has edited a collection of John Cheever's letters, and Ben thanks his sister Susan for first urging him to do it. In the process, Ben also learned about his father. The collection includes John Cheever's letters to and about such literary figures as John Updike, Malcolm Cowley, Robert Penn Warren, Saul Bellow, and Philip Roth. There are also some very personal letters written to his wife and to the women and men who were his lovers. And for Ben, the most difficult revelation that came out of these letters was the extent of his father's homosexuality. Ben Cheever discusses this in his introduction to the book. I asked Ben Cheever if he published his father's letters to help him understand his relationship to his father, or if he had a more literary motivation to make his father's personal writing available to his public.
I did it really out of personal need. I did it because I wanted to keep him alive, and I wanted to understand him better. But really, I think to keep him alive, and I meant to keep him alive for other people. But when I was done with the book and I'd handed in a manuscript and was really pretty much done with what I had to do, I was walking through a town out in the country holding my little son in my arms, and the fire alarm went off, and I thought it was the bomb alarm. I thought it was the end of the world. And my first thought, being very self-centered, is, oh, the book will never be published. And my second thought was, well, it doesn't really matter, because what I had to do in putting this book together, I've already done. And if people like to read it, terrific. If they don't read it, it's still done. And that's what's important. Because the book was, it was a way for me to come to terms with him. I'd say to come to terms with his death, only I don't like the idea that he died, and would just soon not acknowledge that if I can help it.
You know, a lot of writers that I know hate writing letters because it feels too much like work, you know, and they worry about every word being the right word in their letter as much as they would in their novels. And I guess I was almost surprised that John Cheever wrote so many letters.
Well, I know he loved to write letters, and I know he loved to write, and this may be unusual. I remember talking with my mother about him. We were going for a walk when I was working on the book, and I was talking about how much I admired and envied his talent. And she said, yes, Ben, but he had to write. He had to write to live. And I hope that's not true of you. And he really did. He was always doing something with his life. He was translating it. And it was absolutely essential. It was as important to him as breathing or eating or making love. And so, you know, he didn't just write his fiction. He wrote copious journals. He wrote thousands of letters. He was always writing, and he had to be. He had to be.
He once said that saving a letter is like trying to preserve a kiss. Do you think that he thought the letters that he sent to people would be saved and eventually collected?
No, he didn't. I think he thought, and I think he counted on the fact that they would be forgotten, and I'm glad that he did, because that gave him that gives the letters a lightness, a spontaneity that I think letters often don't have. He didn't keep carbons. He didn't keep the letters people wrote to him, by and large. I mean, once in a while a letter would be important, he'd keep it, but most of the time he didn't. So there was just the feeling that this was a kiss, this was an embrace, and he could say whatever he wanted and it would be forgotten. And I'm happy for that, because it makes the book, I think, work. You surprise him. You know, you almost surprise him in his letters when you read them. Go ahead.
Some of the letters are very personal. Did you go through a period of wondering whether your father would want these letters made public?
Well, I went through a period of wondering. I went through a period of experiencing some of these personal letters that was difficult in and of itself. It's not easy for a son to read his father's love letters to other men. But I didn't have any question in my mind that he was committed, and I think there's a lot of confusion about this. He was committed to complete exposure. Now, when he was alive, he lived a fairly private life, or for much of his life, but that was because he was producing his fiction, and he wanted his fiction to be the thing that people were most interested in. However, towards the end of his life, he was talking a lot about his journals being published, and he talked with me about it, and he said he thought it would be a good idea, and he said his only fear was that it would be upsetting for us, his children, and his wife, if she survived him. So I think people don't understand. They read the fiction and they don't understand that he had already made a willing and complete sacrifice of his privacy long before these letters or his journals were published. The most important thing for him was telling a story and was illuminating his understanding of life. And that was just more important to him than any personal consideration. And so what I felt like I was doing in putting this book together was continuing that in a way that he couldn't anymore, because I don't know if he's dead, but he can't write fiction anymore. Wherever he is, the manuscripts aren't coming out. So the only thing we had that we could publish were his letters and his journals, and I knew he would have wanted it. He really would have.
Since putting this book of letters together was in part a way for you to understand your father better, I'd like for you to read one of the letters that he wrote that was about father-son relationships. And this is a letter that he wrote to a man who was a lover of his, and the man remains anonymous.
All right. Dear blank, comma, I'm truly sorry to hear about your father, and I'm much too old to have anything fresh or useful to say. I felt that I must strike some peace with my own father, although we both tried to kill one another. I made him into Leander and struck a useful peace after his death. I think you must do something of the sort. You must try to understand the man. I've told my own sons that when they find me lacking, they can continue to love me and find other men who will wear underwear, pitch no-hitters, and invent the telephone. It seems to work. I think I've known no man who has not accomplished this.
Did he, by the way, directly or indirectly, make that clear to you, that when you found him lacking, to continue to love him and look for the traits that you were missing in other men?
Well, he did say that he had had many fathers and that I should try and have many fathers too. Interestingly enough, my relationship with him was sufficiently intense that I rarely had an older mentor, and I'm only beginning to make good friends with older men now that he's gone.
Were you afraid when you were going through the letters that your father wrote that you'd find information about how he felt about you, information that might surprise or disturb you? And did anything like that happen?
Well, I was afraid. It wasn't as clear as that. But yes, I think I was afraid that I would have to come to grips with things that would make me uncomfortable. And certainly I did. Part of the good news of my father's life is that he loved a lot of people. He loved a lot of people passionately. He loved a number of women, and he loved a number of men. This is good news, because he was also lonely sometimes, and I'm pleased to know that he loved all these people. At the same time, I'm not so big that I'm not a little jealous and a little hurt by the letters that he wrote to young men he loved. He was often very loving to me, but he was very, you know, he was passionately in love with some of these guys.
You know, in trying to think about, because I know that you say that the most disturbing revelation about the letters for you was the extent of his homosexuality. And it never occurred to me, but I see that now, that one of the things that would have disturbed you was a sense of jealousy that he had lovers who were probably around your age.
Well, that's right, and it's odd. I certainly wouldn't have wanted him to consummate his relationship with me in the way that he consummated his relationship with some of these other men. At the same time, it raises serious questions. I've been told by some of the men he was in love with that he would talk about me sometimes as someone who was physically attractive to him. I was completely unaware of this when it was going on because he was very stern in his public denial of bisexuality throughout most of his life. But it raises some interesting questions. I wonder, because a lot of the time, the way he was, when he was angry at me, some of the time he was angry at me because I was a pest. I think all children are, having children of my own. But some of the time he was angry at me because he loved me. And I was just reading his journals, and there's an incident in which I went to pick blueberries. I guess I was 11 years old. And I don't even remember the friend I went to pick blueberries with. It wasn't someone I particularly liked. And I come back from picking blueberries, and he's sore at me because I haven't picked a lot of blueberries. Well, I didn't know why he was angry at me. Well, it turns out he was angry at me because he thought I was off in the woods with this other kid doing something unspeakable. Well, I wasn't, you know. I don't know what we did. We just didn't find a lot of blueberries. So that's very confusing for me. What was love and what was hate? What was genuine disappointment and what was his projection of his own problems on me? It's hard to figure out. I'm sure it's hard for any son to figure out.
Were you jealous that attention he was paying to other lovers was attention that he could have been paying to members of his family?
Well, one of his lovers, who I talked with, and some of them, a couple of them have been very friendly and are friends, said that to me. He said, I felt that I was taking love from your father that maybe you or your sister or your mother could have had. And I really feel, and I say in the introduction, that you have to take the people you love pretty much the way you find them. You can't say, gee, wouldn't have been wonderful if he'd never had a drink. Wouldn't have been wonderful if he'd never loved another man or another woman. Well, he wouldn't have been himself. And love isn't, it's not like marbles. You have three of them and you give one to, you give one to someone and then you don't have one to give to someone else. It's a mysterious thing, and I think probably his love, the love that he had from these people enriched his life, and the joy he got from it probably enriched mine. But I don't mean to say that, having come to this understanding that I'm not capable of petty jealousies, and because I am, but I think when you really examine it, as I had to, you realize that any dramatic change in him would have also changed the man I loved in ways that might not have been fortunate.
Let me ask you to read one of the letters that he wrote to a lover. And we should say here that we've just edited the letter a little bit. We've changed a little bit of the language for broadcast.
Right, this was written from Yaddo, which is a writer's colony where he often went and stayed. Dear Blank, I will call you tonight or tomorrow and ask you to return for the weekend, and when you refuse, as I think you will, I will understand. This seems to be very much a part of my love for you. It all seems quite simple. Neither of us is homosexual, and yet neither of us are foolish enough to worry about the matter. If I want you, I know I have only to ask, and yet I know there is so much better for you in life than my love that I can think of parting from you without pain. This, of course, drives me up the wall. What I want is that which is courageous, intelligent, and truthful for us both. One cannot work out a system of true and false in the space of one's life, but I can find nothing false in my love for you. Of course, it didn't matter that you didn't have an orgasm. It wouldn't have mattered had you come 7 times. It's terribly simple. I love you, and I love to be near you. It is late in the afternoon, and I will go skiing before the light goes. Good night, my love. And I would say, if we were in bed together, and lumped or unlumped, it would be for me a very good night. Love, John.
Let me ask you about one of the lines in that letter. He says, neither of us is homosexual. It seems to me from what you've written about your father and from his letters that even though he had a lot of homosexual relationships, he just really couldn't think of himself as being homosexual at all, that somehow the word and everything it implied meant negative things to him.
Well, certainly he didn't think of himself as homosexual. And I think I have to respect that. That's why I always fumble and come up with the word bisexual. I think homosexual meant stereotypic evil things to him. And so he never labeled himself as that. He used the word in writing and in conversation, but he never really applied it to himself. And that's okay with me. I don't want to force the issue. He certainly had carnal relationships with men, but he also had carnal relationships with women right through his life.
Was he afraid that you were going to be homosexual? Because you make it seem like that was indeed one of his biggest fears.
No question he was afraid that I and my brother would be homosexual. And I think that was a real and an important fear for him. And I think that explains to some extent why he seemed so homophobic. I think he wanted to protect us from what had sometimes been a painful part of his life.
You write about how candid he was with his children and that if he had adultery, he'd not only tell you about it, but you'd find out the shade of lipstick the woman he slept with was wearing. How candid was he with you about his homosexual relationships?
Well, he wasn't candid with me about his homosexual relationships, and in fact, he was so uncandid about it that I didn't suspect it until toward the end of his life. On the other hand, he made a point of telling me before he died that he had men as lovers, and I think that was hard for him to do. I think it was painful, and I think it was courageous.
Did your mother know?
Well, the whole question of how much a person knows and how they know it is a difficult one. So on some level, she must have known. She told me recently that she said, I must have known because when he talked on the telephone, he was always rubbing his behind with his other hand. Now, why that should mean he was bisexual, I don't know, but it meant something to her. And she also knew that he was infatuated with men, because he often was, although she didn't know that infatuation sometimes led to physical relationships.
My guest is Ben Cheever, who has just edited a collection of letters written by his father, John Cheever, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and short story writer. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
A very nice introduction to this collection of letters, and I don't know much about you. Are you a professional writer? I really have no idea how you make your living.
Well, I've always wanted to be a writer. I think everyone in his circle wanted to be a writer because he made it such a stunning, courageous thing. But I've been a writer / editor all of my professional life, and I've always written. But I don't think of the introduction to this book as writing in the way that I have thought I wanted to be a writer. This book, the parts I wrote in this book were just what I thought I absolutely had to say. I'm glad you liked it. But it was just a matter of telling my idea of what I understood what the truth was in this situation.
Would you read the very beginning of your introduction?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The introduction is titled The Man I Thought I Knew, and it begins, When my father stopped breathing, I tried to start his lungs again by blowing air through his lips. Then I put my arms around him. My mother and sister joined in the embrace. I could hear my sister and my mother crying, and then I could hear myself. We were standing at the end of the bed when the man from the funeral home arrived. All three faces were wet with tears. My father was naked except for a fresh white cast on one leg. He had taken a bad fall earlier in the week. His skin was pale and luminous like parchment, and I remember thinking that it looked as if it still had many years of wear in it.
I was wondering if it was very hard for you to write that, in the sense that I think when you're the son of a famous writer, that it's easy to feel in the shadow of your father, at least for a while, and to wonder, what would they think if they read this? And here you were actually describing the moment of his death. Was that hard to do?
Well, interestingly enough, this book wasn't hard in that way, because he wasn't here to write it, you know. If he'd been here to write his description, that would have been fine, and I wouldn't have tried. And I tried because he wasn't here. And I mean, the part I like best in the introduction is a little bit later on in the first page. The Undertaker comes, and the Undertaker is as I guess they usually are, he's rough with the body, you know, with his sacred body. And as he got ready to put it in his station wagon, I said, be careful with him or he'll bite you. And he turned to me and said, don't worry about me, I handled Rockefeller. And I said, but Rockefeller was dead. And I really felt in working on this book, and I still feel very strongly, that my father is not dead in the sense that I had always understood death before that afternoon. It may be that nobody dies in the way that, I know I sound like a crank spiritualist, but it may be. I don't burn candles and I don't. But there were periods of time in my life when I didn't get along with him. There was a period of about 7 years when we only spoke in curt telegraphic sentences. And in many ways, he was gone from me more then than he is now. It's changed for him. That's the hard part. It hasn't changed for me as much as it's changed for him. He can't write anymore. If he was alive, we'd be finding manuscripts somewhere. But I do think, you know, I run a lot, and I'll come around a bend in a park, and I really, honestly, will expect to see him there.
In your introduction, in your preface, in your acknowledgments, you mentioned that your wife is going to learn something reading this, and that is that in one of your rages while writing the book, you actually broke the leg of the old wooden rocking chair and you glued it back together without telling her about any of this. And it made me wonder, what were those rages about when you were writing this book?
Well, I'm not sure what they were about. I think that, there was something that I was trying to consummate, and I'm still not sure whether I have or not. I'm trying to deal with what's happened to Daddy, and I'm trying to deal with the things that I'm trying to deal with missing him. I don't know how to explain it. When I would go, I would work on these letters for a couple of hours, and just sitting alone, I would type them into a computer, reading them, typing them. I would feel like he was around, because he's really there in the letters. You can smell him, you can taste him. I think even if you don't know him, certainly if you did. And then I'd get done, and I'd cry. First I thought, well, it's just because I miss him so much. And then the other day, my wife was writing something and wanted me to read her a line from a Houseman poem. So I looked up, it was To an Athlete Dying Young, I looked up the Houseman poem and read it to myself before I called her and read it to her. And I cried then, too. So maybe it's just the beauty. But yes, it was still is a very painful thing for me to do. It is my hope that this book will be useful for other people who want to do whatever they're doing, come to terms with their lives and their fathers. It's also my hope that finally it will have been useful to me. But hard, yes, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. I'm middle class, so I don't know hardship in the way that many people in the world do. But you know, I've run a lot of marathons. I've certainly had lots of failures in my life. I've had a divorce, and nothing's been anything like as hard as this. And I'm not sure why. Maybe I didn't know that there was such a thing as death. And I had to deal with that. And maybe it has to do with the fact that I thought my father was the rock bed of my understanding of the world, because he was so candid and because he told such gorgeous stories, not just when he was writing, but when he was talking. And to have found that there was so much that I didn't know, didn't understand about him, has kind of shaken my faith. I hope to establish a new and more secure faith as the result of this work. I'm not sure I have yet.
In your acknowledgments, you thank Adam Bellow, who's the son of Saul Bellow, the writer, and you thank him for helping you realize what being the son of a famous writer does and doesn't mean. What have you realized it doesn't mean?
Well, Adam's been a wonderful friend, and all friendships are helpful, but one of the things that I realize is that many of the things that got between me and Daddy weren't of his making or of mine, and have to do with the fact that he was perceived a certain way by the world, and that the world necessarily perceived me a certain way because of it. And it's important to know that that doesn't have to do with him. Saul Bellow and my father enjoyed each other's company and admired each other as writers, but they're very different people. So if Adam and I both have the same cross, the cross must have been given to us not by our fathers, but by the world. Just a little example of the kind of thing that can happen is that I went to a liquor store this summer and signed a check for some bottles of wine, and the girl behind the counter, who had been pleasant with me up until then, said, "Oh, you aren't any relation to the writer John Cheever, are you?" And I said, "Yes, I'm his son." And she said, "Oh, this is almost a great experience," she said. "This is a secondhand great experience." So there is a tendency on the part of people to look at me, see me for a second, and then see him. And I love him very much, loved him very much. We were often quite close, but we are not identical. And that's troubling and even painful. And I think Adam has had that too. And so it was a joy for me to know that a lot of this trouble didn't have to do with him, just had to do with the fact that the world looks at me. They think of me, I think, automatically as, you raised an apt question, they think of me automatically as a kind of second-rate John Cheever. And I think to some extent every son is an imitation of a father, but I'm really not a second-rate John Cheever. I'm Ben Cheever. I may be a second-rate Ben Cheever, but I'm not, you know, we're different, that's all.
Well, Ben Cheever, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ben Cheever edited a collection of letters written by his father. The new book, The Letters of John Cheever, is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with journalist John Huebner about his investigation into the Hare Krishna movement. In the new book, Monkey on a Stick, Huebner and co-author Lindsay Grusin uncover murder and drug smuggling within the spiritual group. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Calvin Tompkins says that in the 80s, the art world developed more intimate alliances with the worlds of finance and fashion. Coming up, Tompkins shares some of his observations about the art world in the 80s. Tompkins' New Yorker articles about art are collected in a new book. Next week, audiences at the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Next Wave Festival will be treated to accordionist Guy Klusevic's homage to the polka, called Polka from the Fringe. In our weekly performance spot, Guy Klusevic gives us a preview. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Hotel Terminus, the documentary on the life of Nazi Klaus Barbie, who was known as the Butcher of Lyon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Nora Rahm. President Reagan today paid tribute to the nation's veterans, delivering a special message of gratitude to those he called the gentle heroes of Vietnam. The president then walked along the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, paying tribute to the more than 58,000 soldiers who died in that conflict.
This memorial has become a monument to that living love. The thousands who come to see their names testify to a love that endures. The messages and mementos they leave speak with a whispering voice that passes gently through the surrounding trees and out across the breast of our peaceful nation.
The president said young Americans should never be sent again to fight and die unless the U.S. is prepared to win. Mr. Reagan also said the U.S. is doing all it can to determine the fate of Americans still missing in Southeast Asia. Palestinians from around the world are arriving in Algiers for a four-day meeting of the Palestine National Council, the parliament in exile of the Palestine Liberation Organization. The council is expected to declare an independent Palestinian state. Israeli officials, fearing riots following that declaration, have closed off the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. Members of all political parties in West Germany today said they respected the decision of the president of the parliament to resign. Philipp Jenninger became the center of international controversy after delivering a much-criticized speech on the Nazi pogroms against the Jews 50 years ago. Deirdre Berger reports from Cologne.
Even members of Jenninger's own conservative Christian Democratic Party pressured him to resign yesterday after he gave a controversial speech to Parliament. A nearly unanimous chorus of critics said Jenninger uncritically repeated Nazi rhetoric in his description of the Nazi rise to power. Critics also said a reflective discussion of guilt would have been a more appropriate subject for yesterday's ceremony than the clumsily worded history lesson given by Jenninger. After he resigned today, expressing regret for any suffering he might have caused to Nazi victims, he was praised both by his own party and the opposition as a man of integrity and a strong opponent of all forms of totalitarianism. A decision on Jenninger's successor is expected in the next few weeks. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
A Navy anti-submarine helicopter crashed in the North Arabian Sea today while approaching a frigate for a landing during a routine mission. The Navy says all three crewmen aboard the helicopter are missing and presumed dead. A full-scale search launched after the crash was called off after only small pieces of debris were found. A Navy official says an investigation into the crash will take several weeks. The Air Force has completed safety inspections of nearly half its fleet of B-1 bombers and returned them to service. Officials had grounded the fleet after one of the planes crashed Tuesday near Abilene, Texas, the second B-1 bomber to be lost in 14 months. Mechanics were directed to check the plane's electric, fuel, and hydraulic fluid lines. Witnesses had reported seeing fire around the plane's left two engines before Tuesday's crash. The crew of four managed to eject safely. Canadian rescuers called off their search today for the 27 crewmen missing from a Liberian oil tanker that broke in half in stormy weather in the North Atlantic. The ship burst into flames after it broke yesterday and sank about 1,200 miles west of England. A group of Soviet officials flew to three Baltic republics today to warn residents against pressing too hard for economic and cultural autonomy. Dissatisfaction in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania has been fueled by political reforms proposed by Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. Baltic residents say the changes will take away their constitutional right to secede. Stock prices fell sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 46 points to close at 2068.28. Advances led declines 4-1 in volume of 135 million shares. The average price lost 59 cents. This is National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. New Music composer and accordionist Guy Klusevic was surrounded by polka music growing up in western Pennsylvania coal mining country. Klusevic started playing accordion at the age of 6 and performed at weddings and parties when he was in high school. But since then, he's taken both the accordion and the polka in some surprising new directions. Next Thursday, Klusevic will begin a 3-day run at the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Next Wave Festival. He'll lead a polka band in his work Polka from the Fringe. It's a collection of short polkas commissioned from new music composers. We asked him to perform a solo version of excerpts.
I decided to kick off Polka from the Fringe with a piece of my own. And it's called The Grass It Is Blue, subtitled Ain't Nothing But a Polka. And it turns out that this piece has a lot of references to musics that I've been listening to for years and that I've been playing as a performer for years as a professional. The most obvious influence in style is bluegrass music, but you'll also hear some quotes from George Gershwin, which I used to play arrangements of his as a kid. You'll hear a little bit of Elvis in the vocal part, and you'll hear a little New Orleans rhythm and blues bass music. You'll hear a little of African rhythmic influence, some quotes from Terry Riley's In C, 2001, Jaws, and at the end, just to keep everybody happy, a little of Three Blind Mice. That was The Grass It Is Blue, subtitled Ain't Nothing But a Polka, and it's a piece that I wrote in 1986. Christian Marklay is a composer and an improviser whose instrument is the turntable. And having improvised with him quite a bit in groups with John Zorn, I got to know and like his music very much. And his contribution to the Polka from the Fringe is called Ping Pong Polka. It's got a lot of beginnings, a lot of middles, and a lot of ends, and a lot of holes where I play an accordion solo part. This is a recording of Ping Pong Polka by Christian Marklay. What you just heard was an excerpt from Christian Marklay's Ping Pong Polka. This is Guy Klusevic. I was the accordionist on that track.
Guy Klusevic will perform Polka from the Fringe at the Brooklyn Academy of Music Next Wave Festival. Here's some more polka music written by Carl Finch. This is Fresh Air. In Calvin Tompkins' new book about the art world in the 1980s, he writes, quote, "The art world continues to expand along lines charted in the 1950s as it forms more intimate alliances with the worlds of fashion, finance, public relations, real estate, and social ambition. Whether this is a good thing or a bad thing is not, to my mind, a crucial question. We get the art we deserve," unquote. Calvin Tompkins has been writing for the New Yorker magazine since 1960 and has written the Art World column since 1980. Some of those columns are collected in his new book, Post to Neo. I asked Calvin Tompkins if in the 1980s, art had become more of an object of financial speculation.
Art has become such a status symbol that a lot of people who have made money fairly recently and want to make a kind of a mark for themselves in the social sense, collect art. And they collect it in the same way that people used to collect yachts or country houses or anything else.
I think it's traditionally been museums and museum curators who decide what the relative value of a painting is, not just financially, but in terms of the artistic merit of the painting. Do you think that collectors are starting to play a bigger role, at least in the financial side, in determining what the value is? And do you think that that's distorting art values in a way?
Well, it's certainly true. The art market is no longer really very dependent on the museum world at all. It moves much too fast for that, and it's the collectors now who are really driving the market.
You describe corporations as the new Medicis, the new patrons of the arts. Apparently, they have a lot of corporations have their own collections now, and to run those collections, corporations have their own curators, their own art advisors. Is there a kind of work that the corporations are interested in buying, do you think?
I don't think you can specify any particular kind. You can say a few things that corporations are not interested in, because they have to please boards of directors and large numbers of executives. The corporate art consultants are inclined to steer away from art that has a political content, and also to shy away from anything that's explicitly sexual in reference. I know of one corporation that a buying committee bought a very large Jennifer Bartlett painting that was a semi-realistic picture of a garden. It was one of her series in the garden, and in one corner of the picture was a representation of a small little Cupid who was urinating in the water. But it was a very sort of minor part of the picture, a small kind of harmless image. And the picture was hung in the boardroom, and the president of the company came in and took one look and said, "No, we can't have that in here. It's obscene." And it was actually taken out.
The things that we've been talking about, money and art, really begs the question of whether the art is any good that is being made. But the impression I get from your book is that you think that some people in the 80s have looked to art more for fashion and status than for meaning.
I think so. And the thing that we all forget is that there are never very many really good, really important artists who are at work. That it's always a very limited number. And I think now one of the mistakes that people make is thinking that in every kind of a new generation that there are a bunch of artists who are going to be top notch and they have to get on to the right ones early. It's probably not true. I think that most of the art that's being produced now is of little value, but that's always been the case. And to me, at least, it seems now as if the art of the 80s is interesting mainly in terms of what certain artists who were active in the 60s and 70s are still doing or are doing new themselves. But I also feel that as Duchamp said, it's posterity that makes the masterpiece. We very often don't know at the time what is the important work.
I'm going to ask you something that might seem kind of personal, so if it's something that you wouldn't like to talk about, just let me know and I'll drop it. I wanted to ask you a question about your stutter.
Yes.
It always interests me when someone who has a stutter is a writer, because it's a way to express yourself without thinking about speech.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering when you started to write.
I started, I was always doing a certain amount of it as a teenager, but I guess I began thinking about it seriously when I got to college.
Was it affected at all by your speech?
Oh, I think probably so. I think the ability to be articulate in another medium, I mean in another way, is there's probably more incentive if you have trouble talking.
Did you ever go through a period of being very self-conscious, or were you able to overcome that?
Oh, yes. I was terribly self-conscious about it for years and years. I mean, it was something that it was a tremendous sort of handicap. I would never have dreamed of doing an interview on the radio.
Well, I'm awfully glad that you are doing an interview on the radio. You started writing for The New Yorker back in 1960,
mm-hmm.
and the first people that you wrote about were people like John Cage, Robert Rauschenberg, Jean Tanguay, Marcel Duchamp, who you're writing a book about now. And in your new book, you say that you responded to all these artists with uncritical delight. No question about it, you were on their side.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that started to change, though, as you started covering the scene more and more and writing about artists who you didn't feel so completely sympathetic with. Did it change the nature of your work as the artists who you were writing about changed?
Well, of course, the artist whom I wrote about first was sort of a case of serendipity. I went from Tinguely to Rauschenberg, and then from Rauschenberg to Cage, and from Cage to Duchamp, and I realized sort of midway through this that I was following a kind of a line of affinities, that those people had many affinities in their work and their way of thinking about art, so that I was really the thing that I felt drawn to specifically was that attitude, was that cast of mind, that feeling that art is not as important as some people feel. It's not a religion, that what really matters is daily life and what we do with it, and that art can enhance that perhaps, but that it has to be part of daily life and not above it.
What about the object itself? Do you feel the need to have art objects in your house? Or I know actually some art critics don't like to collect at all or to have art in their house so that someone can say, well, Calvin Tompkins owns one by blah, 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 so his price is going to go up.
Well, I've never been a collector.
Mm-hmm.
I have acquired, over all of these years I've been writing about, I've acquired a few things just are just in the course of it, but it's not a collection, and it's very meager in terms of what a lot of people have. But I prefer to look at art objects somewhere else, I think, than in my own house.
How come?
I'm not sure exactly. I think for a lot of us that something that's around all the time becomes invisible. We don't really look at it anymore at all. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we go out and see something in a museum or in someone else's house, we tend to sort of give it a degree of concentration and attention that's part of the process. As Duchamp said, it's the spectator completes the artistic process.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kelvin Tompkins reports on art for The New Yorker magazine. His pieces are collected in the new book, Post to Neo, The Art World in the 1980s, published by Henry Holt. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a rundown on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, Nina Totenberg is going to tell us about the Reagan administration's decision to enter a case at the Supreme Court that would overturn Roe v. Wade, the decision that covers abortion as being part of the right to privacy. Also, we'll be hearing about the story of a Vietnam veteran on this Veterans Day, whose adventures in the Florida Everglades recalled to him his time in the jungle in Vietnam. And we'll be hearing about a political crackdown in Czechoslovakia, where a meeting between Western and Czechoslovakian human rights activists was broken up today by police. It's been one of a number of violent measures by the cops recently.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. November 9th and 10th marked the 50th anniversary of Kristallnacht, or Night of the Broken Glass, 2 days of ruthless assaults on the Jews of Germany and Austria that marked the start of the Holocaust. A new film is now opening around the country documenting another part of the Nazi terror, the German occupation of France. The film is titled Hotel Terminus. It's the story of Nazi Klaus Barbie. Our critic-at-large Laurie Stone has this review.
I'm not a fan of cultural marathons. I didn't last out Abel Gance's movie epic Napoleon, nor Peter Brook's 9-hour theater piece The Mahabharata, but I was engrossed from beginning to end by the 4.5-hour film Hotel Terminus. It's the work of French director Marcel Ophuls, who also made the 1971 mega-documentary The Sorrow and the Pity. Hotel Terminus chronicles the life and times of Nazi war criminal Klaus Barbie, known as the Butcher of Lyon. The movie is named for the building where Barbie was headquartered. In 1987, having eluded justice for over 40 years, Barbie was tried in France, convicted of crimes against humanity, and sentenced to life imprisonment. But Barbie is absent through much of the film. Instead, Ophuls concentrates on witnesses to Barbie's acts, and they are a copious slew out of Dickens or Balzac. A German compatriot speaks wistfully of the former Gestapo officer. A torture victim re-evokes the scene of watching Barbie savage her husband and son. An American intelligence operative speaks about employing Barbie after the war in an anti-communist effort. And one of Barbie's drug-smuggling cohorts in Bolivia is pressed into an interview. In 1951, with a French court about to sentence Barbie to death in absentia, he escaped to Bolivia with American assistance via the Rat Line, a network that smuggled out Nazis. In Bolivia, he prospered for several decades, functioning as a security advisor to the right-wing dictator Hugo Banzer Suarez and wheeling and dealing with Latin and German fascists. Part of the pleasure of this film, and it is a pleasure, is watching Ophuls, who speaks fluent German, French, and English, worm truth from his subjects. Often they don't tell the truth straight out. A former Ratline operative accuses Jews of making up crimes and persecuting Nazis. An American counterintelligence officer says, with admiration in his voice, that he didn't believe that Barbie was a torturer because he had so much natural authority. Barbie himself says that the word Nazi doesn't exist. Some of Ophel's most powerful footage profiles Barbie's lawyer, Jacques Vergès, a left-wing critic of French policies in Algeria. He makes common cause with Barbie on the basis of mutual hatred of Zionists. Not only is the reasoning ghastly, but Vergès, who is of Asian descent, is a person whom Barbie the Nazi would have, and no doubt still does, deem subhuman. Ophel sometimes charms his subjects, sometimes speaks ironically, and sometimes hammers. What crimes against the Reich could a 2-year-old girl commit, he demands of a fleeing ex-Gestapo officer. Ophel's camera stares unblinkingly, while liars squirm. Barbie, however, doesn't come across as a hypocrite. His corruption of language is part of his moral and emotional hollowness. He knows no shame. He feels his appetite for control as a birthright. He is successful because he's never sorry, never above using blackmail or thuggery to get by. And in this way, he was able to thrive. Hotel Terminus emerges as a map of post-war corruption, with Barbie as an every slime. He croaks proudly in the swamp, where secret governments direct foreign policies, where American heads of state make alliances with drug kingpins and fascist dictators, and where dead-eyed bullies are esteemed for being macho.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with film director Taylor Hackford. His new movie, Everybody's All American, stars Dennis Quaid and Jessica Lange. Hackford also directed An Officer and a Gentleman and Against All Odds. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by soprano saxophonist Jane Ira Bloom. And on the 25th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy, TV critic David Bianculli reviews several specials remembering what, for many, is the seminal event of the 60s. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.